Okay.
Let's go ahead and get started here, okay?
So
you might have noticed there's no lecture questions for today. First off, I wanted to find out how the first round went, and I didn't get a chance to check it this morning because I had certain car issues. When your car starts smoking when you're driving home, you know you probably should take it in for service. So, but it's like, we'd been taking it in. I'm sorry. So, anyway, I haven't got a chance to look at how the quiz went, but I wanted to find out first off, how did it go? You should have all aced it. What?
100%. I carefully copied down all the answers while I was in lecture and then promptly forgot to do the quiz.
Okay.
So, not well.
Not well. Okay. So I think I'll look at and see what the numbers are and stuff, but the one thing is you shouldn't consider any of these things to be particularly important. One thing I could do is make them. I'm not planning on making them harder, actually. I want them to be relatively easy. But more, I'm trying to decide, does it make sense to just have them one a week and be questions from both lectures? The only issue there is then I don't necessarily get feedback from you in the middle of the week, but I should probably just plan on getting them in, we can do it for the next week. But in that case, I would have it due like on Friday midnight or Saturday midday, which is... So as to remember in your drunken stupor and then try to do the tests? Okay, that's...
You come home Saturday at 11, you're like, oh, God.
I think it's fine.
What, huh?
2 weeks is fine.
2 weeks fine?
You're still fresh.
Because that's the other thing, is like if you don't do it then it's like you've forgotten, and that's one of the reasons why I don't want you all kind of taking a week off and not thinking about it. Okay, so... Okay, so it's fine. Okay, I just want to see any kind of real, kind of like, no, I can't deal with this. It's too much stress or
we
something.
Should have one every minute.
One every minute. Okay.
Always.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. So there are. So yeah. So there's the whole clickers. The other thing. So starting tomorrow, tomorrow there's going to be a tutorial again. You all should have gotten by this point checked off for the first tutorial. You should have all. If you showed up. So you should be showing up for your tutorials. If you don't show up for tutorial, it's up to the TAs how much they wish to be merciful on you, but it's their time, it's their office hours, it's up to what they want to do. But basically, you should plan on coming to tutorial and. And doing those things. Because generally, your check-off thing will be pretty simple starting off. As it goes on, it's going to be your milestones, and that will be more work because you're actually going to have something. But this week, you should have teams. Okay? I assume you should know who you're working with. What exactly you're doing, you don't have to have decided. You have another week to have a plan for that. But you should know who you're doing things with, because tomorrow we're going to form your teams. We have GitHub up and running. We have an EDU diamond plan with 300 repositories we can set up. So we can, get you all set up with nice private repositories that we can then monitor.
Speaking of GitHub, do we want to, show them how to use those?
That's going to be in tutorial, yes.
Okay.
You give me a nice thing. We're gonna talk about it tomorrow morning. That's tutorial. But actually, Brian, we'll talk. I don't want to talk about the specific commands of GitHub, of Git in general. But I will talk about the general model and how I should talk about how version control works, just so you have some conceptual understanding. Then when you go into lab, so topics for today. Let's. So Git, I want to talk about databases. I can talk more about, there's also kind of carryover from Tuesday. How much? Any kind of like really burning questions? I covered a kind of a very high level, rather big chunks of computer science there, but
I don't want to go into too much detail. I figure you'll learn it as you need it, but if the model seems kind of fuzzy, I can go into some of that. We'll bring that up in a bit, but these are kind of the two things I kind of want to talk about today, and I'm sure other topics will come up as we go. So first off, let's talk about Git. So Git is a rather interesting program in terms of its history. Anyone know who wrote the first version of Git? I mean, he's not a major developer on it now, but Linus Torvalds. Linus Torvalds, Mr. Linux, wrote the early versions of Git. He architected, built the first versions, then handed off to other people to develop further to make kind of user-friendly and stuff. The question is, why? Do we know?
Buddies arranged
to
help maintain Linux.
What, huh? Well, to help maintain Linux was a tool he needed. Anyone know why he bothered implementing it? Because he really kind of did this really fast when he decided to do it. So, back in the day, Linux source code was managed with something known as CVS. So CVS is this old version control software. I'm going to tell you what version control software is in general in a second. But there's this old version control application, kind of crufty, kind of slow. People kind of used it. It turns out as Linux got bigger, it didn't really scale handle the amount of source code that Linux had, so people weren't really using it. Then they decided they needed something to manage the workflow. They needed some sort of real version control system, and so they moved to a product called BitKeeper. BitKeeper was a proprietary product, but it was freely licensed to all the Linux developers. And they really needed something like this at the time, and so they said, sure. And there was a big discussion in the Linux kernel community going like, wait, we're developing this, you know, free open source software. What are we doing depending upon these proprietary tools? You know, it kind of goes against things. And they kind of go like, but it's so useful. It works so well for our things. It doesn't touch our code. So some folks in the Linux kernel community decide, well, I want my own tool to be able to pull data in and out of this BitKeeper tool. So I want to make import-export things. So they started reverse engineering the protocols of BitKeeper. Pissed off the guy, this guy Larry McVoy, who did this, and he started getting nasty about this reverse engineering and started sending some nasty notes to the Linux kernel community and stuff like that, and pulled access, I think, to BitKeeper for a couple of people or something like that. And I forget exactly what he did, but he started using his proprietary rights to control how software was used. And that pissed off Linus. It pissed him off enough that he said, damn it, I can make something. And so he went off and implemented a bare-bones tool that was much faster than BitKeeper. In like 2 weeks. Don't piss off super hackers. They'll re-implement your product for it. And so he implemented the base thing, and then something that would be designed to be wicked fast on Linux, and then people have been building on it since. Now, there are competitors to it, and I'll explain the nature of these competitors and stuff and the models of what we're talking about with version control, but Git has become very popular and is used for all kinds of things. So when we're talking about version control, what's the problem? What are we trying to solve?
Tracking changes to the code.
So what this is fundamentally about is you've got some set of documents. Normally, since we're programmers, we think of this as source code, but in principle it could be anything. You have a set of documents, and these documents are evolving over time. They're changing. And so we want to have very fine, we want to keep all versions. We don't want to say, I'll record a version today, and then I'll make a backup copy in a week, and I'll make a backup copy another week or something. I want every change tracked. And with every change, I potentially want a log message associated with it so I can know exactly what has happened. So you can actually look. Every time a developer says they make a commit, and say, oh, there's another version. So maybe they've just changed two lines. Okay, you have a record of that. So very fine-grained control. You, of course, don't want to then store entire copies of the documents every time one line changes. So these version control systems store diffs of some kind, deltas, changes from one document to the next. And they let you see a log of all the changes for every file or for the entire repository or directories or whatever. In the software development context, though, what matters when we're talking about version control is how many people are accessing the repository and how do they interact. So the standard model of version control, or the older version of model of version control, is known as centralized. So examples of this are things like CVS and Subversion. What, huh? If you're looking for older ones, there was this SCCS.
Perforce.
Yeah, and Perforce, you're looking commercial side. Kind of RCS.
Just a floppy drive that was, or floppy disk that was passed around.
No. So these are, but when we talk, version control is actually, do you all know the diff utility?
Yeah.
How many of you have heard of diff? So there's this old style Unix command line utility called diff. And you give it two text files, and at a base level it can tell you whether they're different or not. If they are different, it can output that difference in a number of ways. One way is as an ed script. So ed as this line-oriented editor. So it would say, take the source document, take this ed script, and it would edit the document to turn it into the destination script. That's what the diff thing would output. Then there are these things called context diffs, which is what you more normally see diff used to output, which have this nice notation of, you want to add a line, it puts a plus sign in front. You want to remove a line, it puts a minus sign. You want to change line, there's all this notation in there. It's actually a relatively easy format to read, and the nice thing is it also provides context. So any lines that have changed, it shows some of the unchanged lines before and after it. And so diff is the basis of source code patches. So normally version control is thought of in terms of patches first. That I have this program, I made a change, like let's say you want to send it to another developer, what change did you make to the program? You don't send them the whole file, you send them the diff. And they can use a program called patch to modify their file using diff. Now you might say, well, what's fancy about patch? Why is this actually an interesting problem here?
Well, the other person also made changes. It gets hairy.
Exactly, and that's where the context diffs come in. Is, let's say you have two people working on the same file. One person made some changes, the other person made some changes. They want to now merge their documents. What you can do is extract a patch from an original version, an ancestor of both their versions. So let me try drawing this up here. So we have A, and then we get documents. A prime, and then A double prime. So this is for one developer made this change, another developer made this change. And so we can get the diff of and send that. So we'll say the developer X. Goes, my notation's horrible here. That's the this is the problem that Patch is designed to solve, because Dev Y does not have A anymore. Well, they might have a copy of it lying around, but what they have is a file that they've made their own changes to. So they want to make a combination of these two. Now, if they've been working on different parts of the file, this is in principle, you know, there's no conflict. So what Patch can do, though, is apply the patch in the right place, even though the line, the exact line position of where the changes were made is different, because it has context. It knows these lines were this before, these lines were afterwards. Oh, I can apply this patch. I might have to offset it 20 lines, but it will apply cleanly. So Patch has lots of fancy logic for how to do this. So that's originally how the Linux kernel was developed, was the developers would make their own changes, they would make get patches together, and they'd send the patches to each other, and then they'd merge them in. And Linus Torvalds' workflow was about managing these patches that came from developers, and he had to figure out where to apply them and stuff, and sometimes because things would be different, and patches would fail to apply, and go like, well, where does this patch go? What were they trying to change? That code they were trying to change doesn't exist anymore or something. He'd have to figure that all out. Version control is based on this idea, but the system stores all these diff deltas inside the system. So CVS, well, RCS is just a small extension to this patch mechanism for doing single files. CVS is a set of extensions to RCS to allow to do directories instead of just files. Now, the basic problem with basing things off of diff is text-oriented. And what if you want to handle binary data? You might say, well, why do I want to do this with binaries? Well, what if you want to use documents that are Unicode? Or documents that are, or maybe you're doing image files, whatever. To do full modern version control, you want to be able to handle chain differences between arbitrary files. So instead of patches, you want deltas. So there's one program called xDelta, which lets you take out, find binary diffs between files. So Subversion is basically like CVS, except that it does binary things. It's based on xDelta, but it's a centralized repository. You send things in. So when I say centralized repository, what I mean is there's one system running a server where you can check out a version of the code and check in revisions. That's the basic idea behind version control. Check out. Get local copy. So this is get a local copy of a tree. The entire source code for a project. Check in. Commit changes. When you do a check-in, how can that fail? Assuming you can talk to the server. Exactly. What if there's been another check-in since you've checked out? So that means that all of a sudden the file that you want to update has already been updated with other changes. So what you also have is an update. You have to update your repository in some way based on what other people have done. You pull the changes, so update. Now, when you pull the changes into your repository, it is possible for you to have conflicts where you change the same code as someone else changed. So good version control systems notice this, and they report it. And they say, there's a conflict, help! And you have to go in and resolve the conflict. Decide what wins. I mean, the system tries to be smart, but you don't want these systems to be too smart, because you're getting into semantic changes in the code. You just want them to randomly merge things together that doesn't make any sense. So these systems try to do it. If there's clearly, okay, these are separate parts of the code, I'll just merge it in. But you can still get things breaking when you update things, because they may not have changed the same text, but they may have changed the semantics of the program. And so change a declaration somewhere, and now your program won't compile. So this is the sort of thing that can lead to breaking the build, as they say in a big development shop. When you start checking in versions, you now start getting conflicts between them, and even if the conflicts aren't actually in the text but are in the semantics, now all of a sudden you have a version of your program that, let's say the entire Windows operating system, you check in a modified version, and now Windows doesn't build. I mean, if you're in a large organization, you break a build, people get very ticked off.
You have to bring donuts.
But then
fix it first.
Fix it, yes. Fix it first, right. So this gets into, though, this notion of centralized management. Is there's a single repository that all developers are accessing. They pull their code from it, they make changes, and they commit their code to it. That's not, in general, the development model of open source software nowadays. Why not? Well, it requires a centralized location, but there are places like GitHub and other places that can provide, source forge that provides centralized things. You could do things through there.
There'd be a lot of change. Everyone's working on Linux at one time. It's probably significant numbers. There'd be a lot of changes happening at once that they need to have. So essentially manage all those changes and make intelligent decisions on some changes that were put in.
Okay, that's kind of it.
People might actually be running concurrent versions that they're developing separately.
So, in a centralized repository, you do have a notion of branches. So a branch of code, it says that we go with 0.1 to 0.2 to 0.3 to, this is our main line of code. We're having revisions, we're assigning version numbers. Revision control system will assign versions for you, but you may want to tag them with your own version numbers as opposed to having build number 5623. You give it some more semantics. But let's say you want to try something radical. You want to try adding some feature. You know it's going to break things. You know it's going to cause regressions, you're going to cause problems. You don't necessarily want to do it in the trunk, in the main version everyone's playing with. So what you do is you want to set up a branch. So notice the tree metaphor. That's going to. So what we'll do is we'll take this and we'll branch off. And maybe instead of 0.2, we'll say it'll be 0.2b. We'll say x-0.2. And this will be, we'll go to x0.3. In general, version tags can be arbitrary things. They can just be strings, or sometimes they're sequential numbers. In something like Subversion, everything, it's incremented purely. It's a monotonically increasing number, but so x03, x0.4. So this is this experimental line. You get their own versions. What's the relationship between these and these? Potentially nothing. All you know is they had this common ancestor here. And then who knows what happens. So you have forked the code. Once you fork the code, you at a later point go, I think we should merge back into mainline. So you do a fork, and then you want to merge. This is actually how open source development normally happens. is that given developers have their own version of the program, they hack away on it, make changes, and then once they actually have some bit of functionality they think is useful, they'll take those changes and they'll want to merge them back into the mainline code. So, for example, a Linux kernel developer will be sitting there hacking away on some subsystem. Maybe they're messing with the mass storage layer. They'll make all their changes. They'll do all kinds of crazy things. The rest of their code they won't mess with. They'll just mess with the mass storage. Once they have something together, they'll want to merge that code back with Linus. They'll want to send it upstream. Give them saying, here it is. But in the meantime, other people have been hacking on all kinds of other parts of the code. If you, as a developer, had to deal with your code being changed underneath you, like by hundreds of other developers all the time, not a recipe for sanity at all. That's why when you're doing development, you say, okay, I'm working on this version, I'm going to do development for a while, and then periodically, when you're willing to deal with some amount of chaos, you'll update your code. You'll do a pull from the master repository and merge those changes into your code. But then you know that, oh, my code was working, I just did a pull, now my code is broken, now I at least know if someone else's code changed things, why did my stuff break, now I can figure it out. This is how you stay sane in a world of constant code churn. But this forking and merging is what you do all the time. In a centralized repository, you can kind of do that, but the system doesn't, it's not a first-class operation. It's often very slow to set up forks and merges or awkward. And really what every developer, and also you have to have the centralized repository. So the model now that people are going with are distributed. Version control. Git is an example of a distributed version control system. In a distributed version control system, the patch set, the set of diffs, so becomes the primary unit. You actually don't have a collection of source code or files. You have a collection of patch sets. And the version control system allows you to manage the intersection and combination of all these patch sets. And that's what the really big open source developers spend their time doing, is they're taking patch sets that come from all of these different developers and merging them constantly together and finding out, okay, these patch sets worked well together. Oh, when I bring in this one, it breaks these other guys. So, okay, go fix your code. This one, now I've got some weird, subtle bug. Let's start bisecting our things and trying to find out what patches are responsible for this. It's managing code, not at the level of lines, but the level of these patches.
Is there a certain point where, like, you have, like, your code and your code's so much, and then you say, like, okay, so this is, like, our base code again, and then you start
patching?
Release.
That's a release. Oh. As I'm saying, this is the trunk. Normally, there's some sort of mainline release, someone who's managing and saying, here's a release. But the individual developers working on things have forked their code, have their own version, and they're constantly merging things back in. And whoever's managing the trunk line, I mean, there may be multiple trunks. I mean, if you think of the Linux kernel world, there's the trunk that Linus Torvalds maintains, but there's also logically the trunk that Red Hat maintains, that Ubuntu maintains, and all the different distributions have their own main version of the Linux kernel that they use for their distribution. They're constantly referring to Linus's one, but they don't necessarily follow it. A lot of them have diverged significantly. Android has their own divergences. Yes?
I guess it's worth making the point that version control and release management are kind of related but separate concepts.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, release management is about blessing certain versions and doing testing and making sure that they are fit for outside consumption according to some metric. Version control is something you need as part of that so you can know what code you're doing this with, and when you find problems, they can give you a way of finding out, well, hey, there's a problem here, where did that problem come from? Give you some history. We knew it didn't used to have exist in a previous version, but this is an underlying technology. There's other, if you look at things like Perforce and stuff there, these are integrated into larger systems of managing software. Even you look at GitHub. GitHub is built on Git, but it provides some other tools for understanding what's happening with your code. It's not full release management, but it's for understanding.
They let you post downloads.
And they let you post downloads. They let you look at the statistics and things of who's doing stuff. Is there a bug tracker associated to it?
Yeah, so
bug tracker.
Milestones and stuff.
So that's the sort of thing we're talking about for our general software engineering, software management. So you can use feel free to use these tools as you want. You'll have a private repository through GitHub. Don't necessarily, you know, if you think you have something amazingly cool that you've developed that you want to get a, you know, a plan to be worth, you know, tens of millions of dollars, okay, maybe you don't necessarily want it there, but I'm guessing most of you are not planning on building something quite so valuable, and if you do plan on doing something like that, we can make special arrangements. Yes?
Do you have to use Git for a project?
Yes. You have to use Git? And you have to use GitHub and have your repository there, your set of teams there. If you have a reason to not want to, such as you are really concerned about the confidentiality of your idea and you don't want to have it going to some place like this, talk to the TAs or me and we can potentially arrange it, but you better have a really good reason. How many of you have used version control before this class? About half. Not as many as I'd like. I know some of you are like third and fourth year here, so those, if you've taken 3007 and stuff, you're going to have done stuff like this. This is something you should be using more. So here we are doing it in a second year class. But, oh, what I didn't tell you, which is actually the kind of cool part, is how do you make this fast? That's one of the real tricks of this is you're having to potentially manage thousands of files, doing diffs on thousands of files, and being able to merge changes between thousands of files and find them. And how can you make these operations like branch and merge happen like that? Any thoughts? Well, metadata, yeah, but basically you need really fast ways of comparing files.
Database?
No. Turns out databases, people have tried using databases for these of various kinds, so this actually gets into our discussion of databases. Slow. You start sticking SQL behind this sort of thing, and you stick something like Linux kernel in it, and doing these sort of operations, and it's just bad. It's just not pretty at all. But you use Git, and these things, these operations take seconds. Or otherwise, it would take minutes or something. CVS was really slow about this. The key thing is you don't want to be doing lots of comparisons of files. What you want is to compare something that's a shorthand for the files, that lets you know what the contents are. Hashes. So you look underneath any major modern fast version control system, you see cryptographic hashes, typically MD5. MD5 is not a secure hash anymore. It can be broken in various ways, but if you're assuming a non-malicious adversary, you're probably fine. So don't be checking in malicious source code into your version control system. It might corrupt it, but otherwise, you should be fine. Yeah, if you're curious exactly how this works and stuff, that's worth you looking up and stuff, but I'm just saying that the thing that makes this really fast is they're doing addressing of the files using hashes of the files. So they can say, are these files the same or not? They don't have to compare the files, they can just compare the hashes of the files. So, lots of cool algorithms here. It's worth looking into it, particularly the design of Git and stuff. You're like, wow. Because essentially it's kind of a content addressable file system. What they built. So, anyway, version control, basic ideas. You're going to be using it with Git. The nice thing about doing this whole branching and merging stuff is that means we can make up versions of code, or between the multiple developers in your team, you can each have your own versions. Then you can pull out your change sets, compare them, send them to each other, merge them in. This all works really nicely. And you can do all your development offline. One nice thing about Git is that when you have a copy of the repository, you also have a copy of the entire history of the repository. It doesn't just give you the current version, you have all versions locally accessible. It's a fully self-contained repository. That means that if your main repository goes away, if GitHub were to disappear tomorrow and you have a checked out version, you have everything. So.
Is there a way to do it thin if, say, you don't have a lot of disk space or whatever?
Don't use Git. Git can be a bit piggy. But frankly, Git is very efficient in how it uses space. But that means that anything you add to Git is always there. And this is one of the things that can lead to problems. You say, I checked in this really big file or added these things into my Git repository, and now I really don't want them because I just added 100 megs to it accidentally. Oops. Start a new repository. Deleting.
There's a magic command to fix that.
Yeah, you can delete
it. It's the very last chapter of the Git book.
So there are ways of deleting stuff, but the whole design of Git is not to lose data. You're kind of going against its entire design. So it's possible to do those things, but they're fundamentally dangerous. And it tends to lead to weird error codes because the record isn't completely gone. Basically what it's going to do is find that, oh, change sets have disappeared. And it will probably whine about it. And you'll see little holes in your history. It's not that you can make that history go away. It just says, I forgot something here and I don't know what I forgot and I'm sorry, but...
can roll back, like it agreed that it's
you can
it
roll
the philosophy, but you can step back in time and say the head is back
the
where it was
is
a month
if
ago.
That other people pulled that down, it's kind of now diverged. They're going to be like, where did that file go?
Right.
That's rolling back your repository is like, I mean, these are dangerous operations, and then it kind of breaks the whole thing of being able to merge things. So when you put stuff in Git, it's there forever. Unless you really are talking about messing with the repository, you should assume there is no delete command in a version control system. That's exactly what it's designed not to do. So keep it in mind.
Just very quickly, in terms of, so say you did something silly, you added an image of a DVD into there,
mm-hmm.
So you want to start a new repo, and you do. What about all the other people who are using it?
They can't merge anymore.
So
they're going to need to start. They'll have to branch off of your repo, or you'll have to do some sort of change set that you can try to merge. Yeah, it just it's. There are various ways of doing this, but yeah, you're kind of.
So, while I appreciate the dangerous operations sort of
mm-hmm.
Disclaimer, if you're on your own branch, you did something stupid to your own branch, you roll it back. There isn't really a danger.
Well, if you've done your own branch and you want to merge it in, it's possible. But what you're probably better off is going back to your trunk, making a new branch, and then merging and basically merging your changes into it.
And killing off the branch entirely, the one that you mucked up?
Well, kill that copy of the repository completely.
Right.
Just blow it away. Yeah, when you start wanting to delete things, it's all bad. Good questions? Oh, sure.
While I was working at Adobe, someone uploaded 300 megs of testing files. Everyone pulled that down. And that's still in everyone's builds. We've deleted it, but everyone's Git artifact is an extra 300 megs now. They were angry. Specify like a key if you don't want to, and that's like really broken in against database design. But because it was there in the first version of SQLite, like we can't take it out. It's a good sometimes break.
Some software that uses
software.
It somewhere.
Yeah.
The other thing that
but the trouble is it's not even a feature.
Oh,
it's just you just stuck code in there.
Yeah.
You just stuck files in there.
Yeah.
Could have been your porn collection. You know, I mean, just whatever. It's in there now.
But it's immortal.
But it's immortal.
That's what I was about to say. Is do not upload a password or a private key. Don't do something.
Or even things, your comments in your code. You put some comments in your code, you do a commit, then you delete them. They're still in the repository.
No racist comments.
I'm just saying, just remember that everything you put in there, when you do version control, everything is in there. Every version. You can walk through and see everything that was in there. So be aware. Don't think you can just start making all kinds of things. If you want to do that, make a separate copy that's not in version control and don't commit those changes.
What do you exactly mean by repository?
Repository is the central thing which has all the versions of it. So in a centralized version control system, there's a centralized repository, centralized database. Well, it's not really a database, but centralized store of all the files. When you check out a copy, you just have a working copy, which means that it is just the current versions of the files or whatever past version you wanted to check out. With a distributed version control system, when you do a pull, you clone the repository. You have everything that's in it. You have all versions. So this is really cool if you check out the Linux kernel source code and you do a git clone of it, you get all the versions. I don't think the Git repository actually contains everything back to. It doesn't contain all the versions, but it contains really far back because, of course, Git came on the scene in the middle of Linux kernel development, so I have a history from that point on.
But you can't have the comment first. Isn't that
what's
really
different? Yeah. So, good. Useful tool, but understand what you're doing.
Doesn't have to be a big answer, but just out of curiosity. So, say we do this course, we do a project, we have this repo on GitHub.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any university copyright policies at all that would prevent us from then posting it as an open?
You project? Own the stuff you produce. That is in general at the at this university, and in general, but it depends
not
on the
university.
Not all universities, but this university, you own your stuff. You create it. Now, the general rule is you can't do double dipping. You can't, if you do one project and you get credit for it in one course, you can't use that same project and get credit for it in another course.
But you can get dollars.
But you could sell it. Yes, you could do what, but it's yours. It's your intellectual property, it's your creation. But that, of course, means that, these are team projects, so it's, two or more of you. But if you want to go off and spin off a company, go right ahead. And that's why I said that, if you really think that, you can't think that GitHub is not confidential enough for storing your things or something, then I'm assuming that you're sophisticated enough to set up your own private Git repository that we can access, and we can set up by SSH key so that we can supervise it, because sorry, we have to look at your code still. You're doing it for a class. But I'm guessing for most of you, the convenience of using something like GitHub is worth it. Yeah, well, we're using GitHub now because also they've given us
repository.
No. But again, any of these cloud providers, anytime you use them, you don't necessarily know who has access to those things. They will give you basic confidentiality, but if you actually have reasons to think other people are really going to be interested in this, and they might, you're about Chinese government spies or something like that, I'm sorry, we're not protecting you from that.
Chinese government spies. Not sure your private repo is going to be any more superior than a commercial grade service.
You're an agent.
We can talk about that later, but yes.
How big are these diff files and patches?
Potentially very small. It depends on how big the change is.
Okay, but
it's proportional to the size.
On average, though, what?
It's potentially very few bytes if you've only changed a few bytes in a file. They have to have some context and stuff. For the thing, but. They're designed to, there's some metadata associated with these things, but they're very compact things.
So 300 megabytes, that's not small then?
Like your Git repo, when you start it, is going to be the size of whatever you're storing? and then it stores all the changes from there, so it grows, but only at the rate
of your changing things. So, but that means yet, but the only thing I'm saying is not so much, don't worry about size of what you put in Git per se, because Git is efficient. It's very fast. It can store basically whatever you want to throw at it. It should be able to deal. It's quite remarkable. But whatever you put in there, you're going to have in there permanently. So don't commit what you want.
Also, when, agree on a code style first so you aren't getting complex because you changed the indentation.
Oh, yeah. Oh God. Yeah. That's very silly. Are we good? So now on to web application architecture, specifically the backend database. So I told you about CGI bin. I think that's where I was ending up last time with CGI scripts. Was you had a web server running like Apache. It was a long-lived process, but it would start up these Perl scripts or C programs ephemerally. It would just start it up, run the program, and then shut it down. Now, starting up a process in a Unix-based system is not that heavyweight, but if it has to read a 100 meg file or something every time it loads up in order to parse it, in order to figure out, that's not going to work so well. So the architecture evolved to having some sort of back-end system storing any sort of persistent state, and then the web server would access it. That back-end is the database. Now, when we talk about database, we're really talking about an information store of some kind. And traditional database has certain semantics that aren't necessarily what we want for this application. When we talk about databases, we're talking about a program that stores information that you can query. So, stores data, can query. That's what we really mean with a database. Now, there are various kinds of databases that are optimized for storing different kinds of data and that are optimized for doing different kinds of queries. The classic database is known as a relational database. Relational databases were designed for storing personnel information, financial information, various records. All a table is the rows are records, the columns are fields. What makes a relational database relational?
All of the fields, properly designed relational database, all the fields are facts about some key.
All the fields are what, sorry?
Facts about some key in the table.
Okay, that's kind of, but that's...
There's a relationship between the data that is stored, and so ideally you don't duplicate information if you don't have to. You simply point that this piece is related to that other piece.
Okay, yes, I'm looking for...
structure.
I think it's because you can use it to infer other things.
So when we talk about relational databases...
Key value.
So it's not a key value store. That's not a relational database. I mean, a key value store is a simpler thing than a full relational database.
But a relational database fundamentally is not that complicated. All it really is multiple tables,
yeah.
Tables with relationships. What it means is that the tables are not separate. They have connections between them. This is what it means that you can connect them together, is that the class, we're going to talk more about relational database design and the various ways that you design these things and stuff and the different kinds of database stores, but I'm trying to give you now a high-level overview of what the basic technology is. And the technology here fundamentally is not that complicated in the sense of, so when we talk about records, we talk about, and we talk about fields, we want to know about, not keys. No, I'm thinking the fields that you build indices on. My turn. But the unique. Well, you want generally unique identifiers, but that's not the only way to do it. So if we have one table here. So, we have a table. I'll say first name, last name, and we'll add one more for address. So, let's say this is a table of customers. And associated with customers, we've got invoices. So we have another table of invoices. So invoices. And here, we have things like the invoice number, description, the amount. So this is a really simple kind of table. Now, let's say we want to have every invoice goes to some customer. Someone's getting billed. I have this table with customers. What I could do is duplicate. Every time I made an invoice, I could duplicate all of this information, the customers and all this information, in this table. I could add a first name, last name, address, and everything, and just copy it every time I made an invoice. And that would store the information. You should look at that and you go, that's dumb. It's really dumb. So instead, I just want to store something so that I know to go to the customer customer table, and I know that. So I need some way of relating this table with this table. Now, the question is, on what field am I going to relate these? I mean, I could just put in the last name here, and then I could look up the last name here. Put in the first name and last name, and then index on those, and look them up here. But the problem is, if you do that, what do you get? Someone's got the same name. It's not unique.
Can you form another column that is a concept?
We do a combination, but the problem is you don't know what is unique and what is not.
Or can we make a hash on it?
Well, you can make a hash, but it may turn out that all of the data in here, you may have people who have completely identical records, then you probably should merge them. But they may differ very small ways. So you could make a hash of the records. The problem is once the data changes, the hash would change.
But you could have two John Smiths who were born on the same day, living in the same address, and they're still different people, and so you need to make sure that they're
unique. You need to make them unique.
Right.
And so what you do is you generally have some sort of ID. Then we down. We have a customer ID here, and we have a customer ID here. Now here, the customer ID is unique. So every record has to have a distinct customer ID. They don't have to have distinct anything else, but they have to have distinct customer IDs. Here, invoices, the invoice number has to be unique, but the customer ID may be duplicated.
Hmm? What happens if like a customer is deleted? That's a bit weak. The customer ID, like that, so like the next customer ID is going to be that one. Or
so how these are assigned, they don't necessarily have to be sequential.
Like if
they could be randomly generated. It doesn't matter how they're on. They could be have like ASCII number or something. How they're put together is all you need is that they are unique. That's the important part. How you assign it, there may be lots of ways, but you have the unique ID here. These are unique IDs, and then you have a relationship. That's the relational database part. Is that there are these relationships between tables, saying how fields in one table relate to fields in other tables. Not complicated. But this should, just this right here, should tell you a lot about why, about privacy discussion. Why do privacy discussions talk about things like birth dates and talk about your social insurance number specifically?
They work really well as keys, but...
They work really well as keys. Because, think about it, that's a nice unique identifier for connecting the tables in your database. In particular, for doing database merges. I get databases from multiple organizations and I want to correlate the information between them. If everyone's got just first name, last name stored in with slightly different capitalization and maybe, you know, different ordering. I mean, when you start looking at these databases of actual, you know, real stuff, you realize how dirty they are, how much, you know, bad data there is in them. And so database administrators are always looking for ways to clean things up. And so anything they can know is unique is gold, because it lets them relate the tables together in a nice, clean way. And they can merge the data together, and thus they can do queries. So queries based on unique identifiers are easy. If you want to do queries based on these other columns, it won't inject. You could just sort the entire table every time you want to do this, but these are tables that are stored in disk. They're huge, typically. So you don't sort the tables. You sort indices. You actually make a little mini table, which just specifies the order. So, for example, it just might be an ordering of customer IDs. Like, if you want to alphabetize these, you would go through, look at all the last names, first names, you compute them, and then you make an index of them in last name, first name order, which is just a list of customer IDs. So now, if you want to print them out in alphabetical order, you just go through that list, and then query into here for all these values. This is the stuff Oracle has made billions off of. Is relational databases. They have optimized the crap out of this, made them scale to, you know, really big clusters to manage these tables, have elaborate languages for building, managing indices of these tables, for doing queries and stuff. This is business intelligence. So, I mean, it's scaling up, it's pretty cool stuff, but of course nowadays the open source databases are coming in and doing exactly the same stuff. Now, in this context, there's a concept that's very important, which is known as transactions. What's a transaction?
A read or a write? Well, probably a write more so to the name.
No. To add an invoice for a new customer. In order to add an invoice for a new customer, I have to create an invoice here. And I have to create a customer here.
For a new customer.
So a new customer, I have to create a record here, and I have to create a record here. Do I want to add the customer if I haven't actually managed to add the invoice? No. So I want to change two tables together, and especially I don't want to update the invoices table if I don't update customers properly, because then I'll have an invalid customer ID. So I'll have this dangling pointer. So I need to update multiple data structures in a coherent fashion, such that they all the changes happen or none of the changes. Because if they only happen partially, I have corrupted my data structure, which is my set of tables with their relationships. If I make improper changes, the relationships I've set up between tables will no longer be valid. It said that every customer ID is represented in this table. If I break that assumption, then I have all kinds of problems.
Transaction is like this, like a set of instructions that either they all pass or none of them pass?
Exactly. It's a set of data manipulations such that everything happens in an atomic operation, which means they all happen or none of them happen. So the classic example of a transaction is thinking about airlines. You need to update the reservation of reserving a seat and payment. You don't want the payment to happen without the seat being reserved, because then someone comes to the airport and they don't have a seat. You don't want the reservation to happen without the payment, because now you've reserved a seat and you haven't gotten any money for it. You want those things to both happen or neither to happen. So you start a transaction at the beginning of you buying a plane ticket, and then when you finally, you know how when you enter all your payment information, when you're doing any sort of e-commerce transaction, you do all these operations, you say, I want my shipping address, I want this and that, you enter all this in, and then finally you say, buy it. And it says, hold on. Nothing has happened until I report success. What's happening at that point is a database commit. It is trying to commit all the changes to the databases required. If any of the changes fail, everything is rolled back, and you have not purchased anything. This is exactly the semantics you want. But this is why you go through all this work and things like that, and it goes, sorry, you didn't buy it. You didn't make it. Your seat's gone. You wanted it. It was the last seat. It's gone. Sorry. Someone else got it while you were busy thinking about whether you actually wanted to go to Vancouver.
While
you were looking for credit. Now, of course, part of these things often is they put in, they reserve it. They'll say, I want this for so many minutes. So you can reserve things, but it will time out. And if the transaction doesn't complete in a certain period of time, you have to start it all over again. But it's all about updating sets of data structures coherently. This is what actually makes databases tricky to build, is you don't want to be just updating these things willy-nilly. You have to update them following transaction semantics, and if your transaction, and doing that so that you can give guarantees and make it efficient, that's what Oracle has made their money on, because business systems have to generate lots of these transactions all the time for these updates, and you want it to happen reliably. Well, fast, which means parallel, yes.
The concurrency, I think.
You can't really have complete concurrency. No. You can't have two.
So what you do is you can have all the operations happen concurrently until you do the commit. The commit you have to do sequentially, where you check all your invariants. Once you check, the checking of the invariants has to be, you know, is it all there? But if you optimize things right, the checking can be done very efficiently. The other stuff is slow, and so when you do the commit, it happens and you're good, assuming there hasn't been any conflicts. So there's a whole, we will talk more about databases
later in the class, but now I'm just trying to give you an idea of the technology that we're talking about here with these back-end systems. Because when you get to web scale, you have to make sacrifices. So let's recall what we talked about on Tuesday. Latency. Latency is the enemy. When we're talking about big commits on databases, we're talking about adding latency to operations. And it can actually be very high latency operations because you maybe have really big data structures you have to manipulate. You can optimize access to things for read purposes through caching, but when you actually have to mutate it, you just have to operate on it directly. It's all a whole different game. So what people have known is saying if you can avoid having full transaction semantics, if you don't require quite all the guarantees of things being synchronous and things not duplicating records and stuff, if you can live with some amount of messiness, then you can have much faster performance. Can you tell me a company that's really mastered this? Google. They have done this in spades. When you talk about things like Gmail, you might say, it must have a relational database at the back end for storing my email. No. What they have are these things that are close to databases. They have tables. They have indices. They have various keys and relationships and other things. But they don't follow full transactions. There's various ways that they break them. Like you can have duplicates of records putting in there. When you try to add a record to it, it may not add one, it might add five copies. Because it tried it and it failed and it tried again, and you ended up adding five. And so your application, if it's dealing with the sort of system, has to go, let's look for duplicate records. Don't assume that things were added uniquely. So there's some slop in the system that your code has to deal with. But the benefit of this is that they can make the system really scale across thousands of machines. And that's, if you've heard something called Hadoop, it's an acronym, is it?
I think it's
H-A-D-O. I was trying to remember if it's all caps. How many of you heard of Hadoop? So Google has been very good about publishing how a lot of their infrastructure works. But they don't give away their code. They just publish papers saying, this is how we make a really gigantic file system. This is how we do a giant key value store. This is how we, run data across, this is how we index our, the web, and run programs across it and stuff. So they've done all these very nice computer science papers talking about the things they've done, but they don't give out code. So other people have come along and implemented it. The Hadoop project is fundamentally about taking Google published technology and building open source implementations of it. And you know who uses them? Everyone else. Yahoo is a really big contributor. Facebook's a big contributor. I don't know how much Microsoft does in there. They traditionally haven't been so involved in it, although
Microsoft
I think.
SQL's perfect.
Why would they need anything more than Microsoft SQL? Right.
They're getting it good now. They're getting it good now.
Yeah, they are. Well, especially because they're trying to support cloud things. But when you talk about Hadoop, one of the things you're talking about is doing database-like things without full database semantics, which means your code is going to be more complicated than it would be if you targeted a traditional transactional database, like an Oracle server or MySQL. MySQL nowadays is basically a full relational database, PostgreSQL, things. Mm-hmm.
So then, structured, unstructured, I mean, Hadoop is a file system, right? It's
a bunch of things.
Right.
It's not just one thing. It's a multiple pieces. I mean, there's Hadoop,
there's the Hadoop file system, there's a Hadoop big table version, there's Hadoop MapReduce, there's a number of pieces to it. It really is duplicating the Google technology stack as they have published it. Of course, Google keeps changing their technology stack, and so there's new things, and so they're... But... Now, did the world end with relational databases? No, this is like 1970s technology. Instead of relational... So one way to get fast is to... relax the semantics, just get away from transactions. Now, people have known that you can always get faster. It's only when you got into web scale that people have said, we have to relax the semantics. This is not a luxury we can afford. We can't make lives for developers that easy. We have to make it harder. Sorry. But is what you want to store in a data store, does it look like this? What do you probably want to store? What do you allocate storage in your application as? How do you organize your data? Objects.
Well,
you organize your information into objects. Objects with some, you know, with code associated. You know, so you have this data structure with code associated. That's where an object is. So, the future of databases, which is kind of here and kind of not and stuff, is object-oriented databases, object stores. Yes, but they were kind of more toy-like 10 years ago. Well, not toy-like, right? But they weren't scalable like the other ones. They're more scalable now, and we have object stores and we have document stores now. One big trend now is towards storing more unstructured data. Relational databases are great for very structured data, but nowadays we're often wanting to store a lot of unstructured data. Like, for example, a relational database really isn't what you want to use to store video clips. You know, or photos of them. It's just not really optimized for that. It really was optimized for text. And modern relational databases have various extensions for dealing with these binary blobs. That you can see in there, the metadata is kind of here, and the object store is kind of off somewhere else. But there are full-fledged object stores which are optimized for storing, you know, these less structured things. You know, for document stores or object stores and stuff. And depending on what kind of application you're building, you might want to use an object store or a document store. I mentioned this in particular in the context of this class because, oddly enough, Node.js has very good support for doing these sort of things and only pretty good support for supporting backend databases, right, relational databases. It does have bindings for them. They do exist, and you know there's a couple of them and stuff, but it seems to have much better support for these, which gives you an idea of where the developers believe that you should probably be spending your time. The applications people want to build seem to want to more use these unstructured data things. Or semi-structured. You know, you have some metadata, then you have big documents and stuff. Or you can just think of it from a data structure standpoint. If you know the size of everything you want to store, or you can bound it very tightly, you can store it efficiently in certain ways. But if the things you're trying to store are highly variable in their size, you have to use different storage strategies. That's all we're really talking about here. And you can take a fixed size storage thing and deal with a variable size storage thing with some hacks, but it won't be really optimized for it. Instead, you have systems that are fully optimized for it. They do well, but they won't necessarily be as efficient if you want to stick in just purely fixed size record-like data. So it's a question of knowing your application. Chances are most of you are going to probably deal with some mix of structured and unstructured, so don't necessarily default to doing a relational database. As we will talk about, there are other things out there for storing data, and you may want to use those instead. And we'll go through some examples later. But, so I think I have a couple more minutes, barely. So what sort of application should you be trying to build? What sort of applications are going to be really easy to build, given what I've told you these past few days?
What's your application be hard, though?
Something easy would be something that doesn't have to store much data on the server.
Storing data on the server and retrieving it and accessing it is relatively straightforward. Web applications can do that pretty well. What's going to be hard is anything that's going to require lots of low latency in the client. Except if you're doing client-side JavaScript. Client-side JavaScript has become much more powerful. You can do a lot of things, but the APIs for doing the client-side stuff gets much newer. Like, for example, if you're going to do full 3D graphics, you can use something called WebGL. But WebGL is a very new beast, so expect to experience some pain. Now try doing audio. Audio is really not so good in the web space. Doing audio-based applications, you're going to have some problems, particularly if you want to have really fine-grained control over the audio. In general, GUI-type things are better, but again, you have to make sure you aren't constantly having to query your database every time because you have to deal with latency of it, unless you can somehow cache it, predict what the user is going to want.
So, like, two-player games or anything that two clients would have to communicate through the server.
Well, it's okay, except that it depends on how fast they have to communicate. Like, if you're doing first-person shooters through the web and stuff, it's not say you can't do it, but you're probably going to have to do some sort of predictive elements in that. I mean, that's how modern games are done, is that you don't just show the person the way the world is according to their current state, but they have to say, oh, that user, you know, player three was moving on this vector. So let's assume that they keep moving along that vector. And then we'll update it. And then if it turns out they turn, then we now have a little jump in their position. So there are these sort of things to cover up the latency. But things that are demanding lots of quick responses are harder to build. It's not to say you can't build them, but they're harder to build. So keep that in mind when choosing what project you want to do. Okay. See you tomorrow, Monday.
I don't think you're allowed to do that. I feel like that would be fun.
Yo, man.